My guest today, Charles Glass, is a broadcaster, journalist, and writer who began his journalistic career in 1973 at the ABC News Bureau, Beirut Bureau, with Peter Jennings. He covered the October Arab-Israeli War on the Egyptian and Syrian fronts and the Civil War in Lebanon, where artillery fire wounded him in 1976. He was ABC News Chief Middle East Correspondent from 1983 to 1993, during which he was kidnapped in Beirut and managed to escape. His articles appear in virtually every important publication on both sides of the Atlantic. Since 1993, Charles Glass has been a freelance writer in Paris, Tuscany, Venice, and London, regularly covering the Middle East, the Balkans, Southeast Asia, and the Mediterranean region. He's also published books, short stories, essays, in addition to the aforementioned articles. Welcome, Charles Glass, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much.
I'm happy to have you with us. On July 29th, you had an article in The Guardian of London commenting on two contrasting appeals to the international community by Syrians engaged in the struggle against the regime of Bashar al-Assad. One by the Syrian National Council calling for new and better weaponry for the insurgents battling the Syrian army, and the other by representatives of 10 opposition organizations meeting in Rome who asked the world to assist Syria in another way, forcing both sides to reach a peaceful resolution to the conflict. We keep hearing in the U.S. media on Al Jazeera the demands for more weapons, but we haven't heard the reports of those in the opposition seeking a peaceful solution to the conflict. How do you explain that?
Well, in most conflicts, the people willing to fight and make war and destroy homes and make people into refugees and destroy the antiquities of a country tend to drown out the voices of those who want a peaceful resolution that will save their country from all the horrors that come with any civil war. And in Syria, because certain countries, i.e. the United States, Britain, France, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, all powerful countries relative to Syria, have been in favor of regime change and have supported a violent solution from the beginning, most of the media have listened to them rather than to the voices of probably are the majority of Syrians who would like to see the regime sit down with all of the opposition, violent and nonviolent, and come to the kind of transitional arrangement that Kofi Annan was putting forward at the beginning of his mission.
Well, you know, while there's no apologizing for the all too predictable and brutal responses of the Syrian government to rebel attacks, I have the sense that what we were seeing is being orchestrated from the outside by Syria's newfound friends. For example, when the rebels go into Aleppo, we're made to think here the people of Aleppo are uprising, but in fact, or it seems that the rebels have taken their fight into Aleppo, into Damascus, in order to predictably and expectedly to get the regime to then attack, kill people, and then bring about more pressure for direct foreign intervention. What do you think of that?
That sounds like a fairly reasonable analysis to me. Martin Chulov with The Guardian, who's with the Free Syrian Army in Aleppo and has been filing some very interesting reports to The Guardian in London, wrote that in the neighborhood of Salah ad-Din in Aleppo, where he's been with the Free Syrian Army, and he's been very sympathetic in his reporting of the Free Syrian Army, that when he spoke to people in the neighborhood, they didn't know who the Free Syrian Army people were. They were not people from their city. Many of them didn't want them there, and they feared first them, and second the inevitable response of the army in expelling them, which means that those people will probably lose their houses.
Well, and of course Aleppo is one of the, you've written about it beautifully in New York Review of Books, is one of the oldest cities in the world, filled with antiquities, and it was a very important economic city, the most economic, important financial city for the Syrian government, and by and large, until the uprising, both it and Damascus were very, could be considered pro-government.
Well, Aleppo and Damascus both generally were pro-regime, although people in both cities had their criticisms of the regime and didn't like the corruption of the regime, didn't approve of the idea of a one-party state. However, that didn't mean that they wanted to get rid of the regime at the cost of destroying the country through a civil war. They wanted to get rid of the regime through peaceful demonstrations and civil disobedience, non-cooperation with the state, and other peaceful means that they had at their disposal. Remember, when the rebellion began, it began peacefully in Daraa. The government, of course, turned up the heat by shooting at unarmed demonstrators. But they were willing to take that risk and to go on with their unarmed demonstrations, hoping that the regime would be humiliated in the eyes of all the Syrian public and would eventually crumble. But that wasn't allowed to happen because almost immediately some elements in Syria receiving aid through Turkey took up arms and turned it into a war, first mainly in Homs, which large parts of Homs were destroyed as a result. And I spoke to refugees from Homs, some of whom hated the regime and many of whom hated the Free Syrian Army for bringing the regime's artillery down on them and destroying their houses.
Which was predictable, because actually you would say any government under armed attack is going to respond brutally. And
I remember in Philadelphia, yeah, when a neighborhood of Philadelphia was taken by armed men, how quickly the mayor of Philadelphia reacted and used even air against those people and destroyed a neighborhood of Philadelphia to end that, I wouldn't call it an uprising, but that insurrection of some sort.
You're speaking of the MOVE organization. I mean, the whole block was bombed
exactly,
and destroyed by the Philadelphia police.
Yes.
It's something that's could have written out of history, but this is what, and this was not an armed rebellion in Philadelphia at that time, far from it, but they responded brutally with bombing, and they would do this to any American ghetto or barrio that would take up arms against the government, no question about it.
Well, they would do it to Beverly Hills if Beverly Hills took up arms against the government. I mean, that's what governments do. They don't tolerate rebellion.
And this was predictable. It's interesting. In the very beginning of the Syrian protest, a friend of mine in Lebanon, who's a Maronite and not a supporter of the Assad regime, who had been actually shot at when the Syrians were in Lebanon, was reporting that the news reports in this country were wrong, and that already early in the uprising, armed men were moving from Lebanon into Syria, and the price of Kalashnikovs had gone up $2,000 a pop. So very early on, it seems that there were people waiting, anticipating what was going to happen in Syria and taking advantage of the peaceful uprising to jump in and co-opt it.
Well, it certainly did turn violent very quickly, and the Free Syrian Army began to manifest itself much more quickly than anyone ever expected. So whether it was planned in advance, I don't know. I haven't seen the evidence for that, but it's not impossible.
In an earlier article, you wrote a slightly satirical article that comments that the Syrians are now surrounded by more newfound friends than a lottery winner, not since the old Soviet Union, you write, signed all those treaties of friendship with everyone from Finland to Afghanistan, as one country had so many friends. And you ask, how did Syria become so popular that almost half of the members of the UN are scrambling to save it? What other country can claim more than 100 sovereign friends? What inspired this rush of affection for Syria? And then you go on to history of this Israeli taking over the Golan Heights, And then the failure of the world to respond to the ethnic cleansing of the Golan Heights and the annexing of the Golan Heights. And then you ask, would it be churlish to suggest that Syria's friends want something from Syria for themselves? Could you elaborate on that?
Well, yes. Many Syrians are understandably suspicious of the friendship of the United States, Britain, France, Turkey, when those countries have never done anything for them. There are 100,000 refugees from the Golan Heights living in Syria, and no one from those countries ever raised any protest with Israel that they should, under international law and common morality, have let them back into their homes. Faced with that, they are a little bit, they're wondering why, when they didn't do anything for the 100,000 refugees from the Golan Heights, or they didn't do anything for the Palestinian refugees either, why they suddenly are falling in love with the Arabs of this country. And they look, understandably, at America's strategic interests, which would dictate that it's better to have a weakened Syria or a Syria with another regime that would not be allied to Iran. That this is all being done as part of a game to limit Iran's reach in the Arab world, particularly at a time when Israel is contemplating an attack on Iran.
And the Syrians
then see themselves becoming pawns in a conflict between Israel and Iran.
Well, even as I've mentioned in some previous programs, some American commentators, particularly from the pro-Israel lobby or in their think tanks, openly speak of the fact that this Syria is a way to get to Iran. It's a stepping stone. And the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a think tank started by AIPAC in 1985, very quickly enveloped and unfolded the Syrian National Council into its womb, even starting something called the FIKRA Forum on the Internet, pretending that it has Arab interests at heart. How is this going to end?
Well, it is interesting that AIPAC would more or less publicly embrace a Syrian liberation movement when it's done everything it can not to return the Golan Heights to Syria or allow Palestinian refugees to return to Palestine or demand that the Arabs in the West Bank and Gaza be given their independence. They're picking and choosing the Arabs that they wish to defend. But in fact, it seems that they're willing to use these Arabs for their own interests.
The Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where Dennis Ross holds sway, didn't do it so quite openly. You have to look through a couple of websites to find out that this FIKRA Forum, FIKRA meaning ideas in Arabic, is a project of the Washington Institute. On the other hand, we've heard initially that in Israel was quite concerned with the stability of Syria, because Hafez al-Assad and his son Bashar for so many years had relatively kept that border quiet. And now we know that al-Qaeda and other foreign, what they call jihadists, have gone into the fight, although we don't hear that reported that much in the Western press. This seems to be the recipe for endless fighting.
Well, there is always a risk from the Israeli point of view or from Washington's point of view that if they go on encouraging this rebellion and arming this rebellion, that it will be taken over by jihadists who have a much more aggressive line to Israel than the Syrian regime does. I mean, you're correct that from 1974, when Hafez al-Assad signed the agreement with Israel, negotiated by Henry Kissinger, which set the current ceasefire lines along the Golan Heights, there hasn't been a single penetration of those lines by any Palestinian or other guerrilla force from Syria. It has traditionally been Israel's quietest border. Now, they do risk losing that. However, other voices in Israel don't mind taking that risk because they see strong advantages in a weakened Syria locked in civil war, which will no longer be in a position to help Hezbollah in Lebanon or to do Iran's bidding in the Arab world.
On the other hand, one might argue that having jihadists on their border and having threats, being surrounded by threats, is a justification for maintaining their state of belligerency and the high degree or the billions of dollars of weaponry that flows to the United States. One might say that if Israel became friends with its neighbors and was no longer perceived as being under a threat, that all of that would dry up.
Well, there'll always, I would suspect, be some pretext. I mean, for many years, the Israeli state used the Cold War as the pretext for colonizing the West Bank and making life difficult in Gaza and hanging on to the occupied territories. When the Cold War was over, then luckily the War on Terror replaced it, and they could go on being the bulwark of Western civilization against the jihadists. A jihadist takeover of Damascus would probably, in that sense, serve their national interests, I mean, of keeping the temperature up and maintaining a high state of alert and talking about existential threats. Even in the absence of that, they call Iran an existential threat, although Iran has never in its history attacked Israel.
One of the things that we were following, of course, and predictably it was not going to work, was the attempts by Kofi Annan to broker a truce. And I understand he wanted to bring Iran into the discussions, which, of course, was a game stopper on the part of the United States and its Israeli friends, and you know, as well as Britain and France. How do you see the breakdown of the Annan's efforts, and who's really at fault there? Or it was a fault shared by all sides?
Well, I think the fault lies first and foremost, and Kofi Annan has said this. He wrote an article in the Financial Times a couple of days ago saying this. He had an understanding with the United States and the Russians that they would work towards bringing both sides to the conference table. In the event, when the UN resolution was being written to that effect, the U.S. rewrote the resolution so that it demanded regime change first before any conference table. Well, obviously the regime is not going to go to the conference table when it's already been decided that it's got to go. The regime's departure was one of the things to be discussed at the conference table, which is what Kofi Annan wanted to do. So he thought he had a deal, but in fact he didn't have a deal. And without the United States and Russia both on board, bringing Bashar al-Assad and the United States bringing the Free Syrian Army to the table, then there can't be a peaceful resolution. And that's why Kofi Annan finally gave up and resigned.
In other words, the United States was not interested in the peaceful resolution.
The United States seems to be interested first and foremost in regime change, and if it can't have immediate regime change, then of pursuing a war with the objective of a regime change rather than a peaceful resolution, which means that in the meantime, Syria is being destroyed. UNESCO has put out warnings about the art of the antiquities of Syria being looted by criminal gangs. The state is no longer able to protect them all. Even as we speak, the Free Syrian Army has attacked the old citadel of Aleppo, an ancient and one of the most magnificent antiquities in the whole Middle East, which could end up being destroyed. There are 900 what are called dead cities, Greco-Roman Byzantine cities, all over the plain of northern Syria, which will be looted and damaged very badly. And these have been protected since the beginning of the Syrian state in the 1920s, have been protected very well and very well preserved, and tourists have been able to visit them, and they've cataloged all of the antiquities. There are 9 or 10 major museums all around Syria with marvelous collections of Hittite, Sumerian, Crusader, and other civilizations. The artifacts there, all of which are now in danger of being lost, as Iraq's treasures were lost when the Iraqi National Museum was looted.
The prospects don't seem very bright. Now, you've spent a considerable amount of time in the Middle East, and we know that we had the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and I've seen some videos illustrating the brutality of that dictatorship. How would you compare the two regimes, the one under, first, you know, under Hafez al-Assad, then his son, with that of Saddam Hussein, which both came out of two different parts of the Ba'ath Party?
Well, in Iraq, they used to say that if you raised your voice against Saddam Hussein, he would kill you and your entire family and probably your tribe. In Syria, if you raised your voice against the Assads, they would just kill you. That's probably the difference. So Saddam was thoroughly and unnecessarily brutal, whereas the Assad regime has been judiciously brutal. Now, remember, the United States did not disapprove of this. The United States was rendering suspects to Syria for the purpose of interrogation under torture up until 2004. They knew about torture in Syria, which was why they were taking suspects there. They were taken to a prison at Tadmor near the ruins at Palmyra in the eastern desert of Syria, and they were not raising any question about human rights in Syria at that time. It was only later, when the Syrian regime became expendable in their eyes, that they discovered human rights in Syria.
Well, actually, going back to the days before Bill Clinton under the senior George Bush, Syria was considered, if not an ally, at least a friendly country in the Middle East. And, of course, Syria came in and supported the coalition of the willing in getting Iraq out of Kuwait. And that all seemed to change when Clinton became elected.
It didn't change that much when Clinton was elected, because Clinton, after all, did go to Geneva thinking that he was going to deliver a peace agreement between Syria and Israel over the Golan Heights, and he came very close to it. But Dennis Ross, who was his Middle East envoy at the time, was one of those, in almost every account of the Geneva meeting between Hafez al-Assad and the Israelis that Clinton hosted, that Ross had actually misled Hafez al-Assad into thinking that the Israelis were going to give every single inch of the Golan back, when in fact they were never going to give every inch. They were going to give most of it, but not all of it, and he had been promised all of it. So Clinton was actually engaged with the Syrians, but he failed to reach the agreement that he wanted.
Actually, my guess is Charles Glass, we're talking about Syria, of course. I'm going to open the phones in a few minutes to your calls. That reminds me of the story, I don't know how true it was, that Bashar al-Assad was about to reach an agreement with Ehud Olmert about over the Golan. I don't know the exact nature of the Golan, when Israel suddenly launched Operation Cast Lead on Gaza without any warning to the Turks. I mean, the Turks were negotiating an agreement between...
I remember.
And that seemed one of the reasons that Turkey responded, Erdogan responded so violently, or verbally violently, to Shimon Peres, because Turkey had spent a great deal of time negotiating what they thought would be an agreement, disengagement of Israel from the Golan, at least part of it. Do you know any more about that?
Well, you're exactly right. The Operation Cast Lead in Gaza, and subsequently the attack on the Turkish ships, in which some Turkish citizens were killed by Israeli commandos, soured relations between Israel and Turkey very badly, and jettisoned any hope of Turkey being able to broker an agreement on the Golan Heights. Actually, if Israel wanted to get rid of the Iranian influence in Syria and to neutralize Hezbollah in Lebanon as a threat to Israel, giving back the Golan Heights would have been the way to achieve it, because then there would be a peace treaty with Syria, which would then allow Lebanon to have a peace treaty with Israel. And that would mean that Israel had peace treaties with all of its immediate neighbors, and it means that phase of the war is over. The only outstanding conflict then is between the Israeli state and the Palestinian people. But the armed conflict with the states of the region would have been over, and Hezbollah would no longer be getting support from Syria, because Syria would have an embassy in Tel Aviv, and it would want to have good relations with Israel. And they were even talking about a peace park in the on the Sea of Galilee, where both states would have citizens would be able to meet one another. So all of that would have been very good, and it would have diminished Hezbollah's armed power and Iranian influence in the region. But in the event, it hasn't happened, and certainly now with this uprising in Syria, it's not going to happen.
What do you see as Turkey's role in all this? It seems to go back and forth, but and initially appeared to reach out to Bashar al-Assad in a friendly way. To stop the initial repression against the peaceful protesters, and then when that didn't happen, he then turned on Bashar. But is there more to it than that?
Well, I'm told that they simply didn't trust Bashar anymore. That they felt he was not a man of his word. That he had misled them, and other states have said that they've had similar problems with Bashar al-Assad as well. The Turks had then began to arm some of the refugees who came into Turkey, and basically became the umbrella for the Free Syrian Army, which operates out of the border area inside Turkey. And the Turks have given them a significant amount of help, and they've stepped up this in the recent weeks, which is why we see the attacks on Aleppo. What the Syrian regime has done in response is to hit Turkey in its Achilles heel, which is through the Kurds. So the regime in Damascus, in order to pull troops away from the border areas in the far east of the country to concentrate on Aleppo and Damascus, have given autonomy to the Kurds of Syria and have given citizenship to many of the Kurds who were stateless. And in return, the Kurds are now policing that zone, keeping both the Syrian regime out and the opposition out, and basically creating the beginning of the kind of regional autonomy that the Kurds of Iraq have enjoyed since 1991. Now, this absolutely terrifies the Turks, because the largest Kurdish party is allied to the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party of Turkey, which was responsible for the terror war from 1984 until recently. And there have been stepped-up PKK attacks against Turkish army forces inside Turkey. So now we have the Turkish government arming people to fight against the Syrian government, but we now have the Syrian government arming Turkish Kurds to go and fight the Turkish government. So it's spread across Syria's borders into Turkey, and it's going to be bloody in both countries.
Now, this brings up the whole issue of the various religious sects in Syria. Now, the Bashar and his family are Alawites, which is a sect of the Shia. How big a community is that, and is there a likelihood or possibility of, which has been suggested, that there would be an Alawite section of a breakdown of Syria into its religious components, and including the Alawites, the Christians here and Alawites there and so on?
Well, at the moment, the Kurds have their autonomy in their area of the northeast of the country. No one is suggesting establishment of an Alawite state or a Christian state in other parts of the country. The French tried that in the early 1920s, and all the Syrians rebelled against it. The French, when they had their mandate over Syria, cut Syria into four states: an Alawite state, a state of Aleppo, a state of Damascus, and a Druze state in the south. And the whole country rebelled against it. And the French finally gave up and reunited Syria and kept it as we now know it. I don't think it'll wash with most Syrians. However, the civil war is ghettoizing the country. Christians are fleeing. Christians who lived in mixed neighborhoods are fleeing to Christian areas. Alawites who lived in mixed areas with their Sunni neighbors are going back to their villages in what they call Jebel Alawiyah, the Alawite mountain. People are afraid. Many people are fleeing to Lebanon, particularly Christians. Some Armenians are now buying houses and moving back to Armenia. I mean, and although some of them have been in Syria for centuries, they're afraid, particularly the ones in Aleppo now, who see the Turks, of whom they are deathly afraid because of the Turkish massacres that they all remember, and also they're afraid of the Sunni fundamentalists who have no time for Christians and have made that very clear in their propaganda that they want the Christians out of Syria.
My guest is Charles Glass. The number here, of course, is 895-2448. There was someone on the line who went off. What role is Iraq playing in this? Initially, there were some comments from Maliki in supporting Bashar al-Assad, but it's been very quiet lately, although al-Qaeda or some people have stepped up attacks in Iraq. Iraq seems to be an important player right on the Syrian border, but we don't hear much about the Iraq-Syrian relationship at the moment.
Well, there are two parts of Iraq. There's Iraq, the central state in Baghdad, and there's also the Kurdish regional government in Erbil. The Masoud Barzani and the Kurdish regional government have sponsored the Kurdish autonomy in Syria. They brought all the Kurdish Syrian leaders together in Erbil, the Kurdish capital, and had them sign an agreement there, which Barzani can oversee, to possibly to annex the Kurdish areas of Syria to the Kurdish areas of Iraq, or if not annex, at least have open borders and freer trade and common institutions. This would probably be much to the satisfaction of the Kurds in both countries if they could achieve that. But the Baghdad government is very much against this and is also, for the most part, sympathetic to the regime in Damascus because of its own reliance on the Iranians, and the Iranians support Baghdad and Damascus, and both regimes. And so they have a kind of alliance that stretches from Tehran through Iraq through Syria to South Lebanon, where Hezbollah is. So it's what the Sunnis, particularly the Saudis, call the Shiite Crescent, which they're terrified of.
We have a call on the air. Hello, you're on Takes on the World.
Hello, this is Ellen Rosser. I have two questions for you, please. First, why hasn't Kofi Annan and the rest of the world called for free elections instead of a unity government, since free elections is something maybe everyone could agree on? And second, a question about Iran. Why Iran has supported all of the Arab Spring uprisings, except in Syria. Why didn't and why doesn't Iran support the Arab Spring uprising in Syria? And then, of course, the U.S. wouldn't have the opening there that they're trying to get.
Well, I'll take your second question first. The Iranians regard the regime in Damascus as an ally, and they see the opposition to it as not an uprising, a popular uprising. They see it as an American-Turkish sponsored uprising to bring a Sunni fundamentalist regime to Damascus that will leave no role for the quasi-Shiite sects like the Ismailis or the Druze or the Alawites in the country, and then be allied to the United States and hostile to Iran, and then cut the land bridge from Iran to Hezbollah in South Lebanon. So it's a purely, it's not a principled stand in the sense of wanting to find out what the Syrian people really want. It's a the kind of geopolitical decision that the United States often cynically makes, which is not necessarily to support the people in the country, but to support what it perceives as its own interests. Then on the elections, Kofi Annan is certainly in his plan is in favor of elections, but the modalities of the elections were to be worked out in consultation with all of the parties at the negotiating table, and the elections would certainly have been a part of it.
Okay. I still don't understand why Iran couldn't support the rebels and thereby have good relations with them and still maintain its interest in the country.
Well, many of the rebels are Sunni fundamentalists who would not in any way have anything to do with the Shiite regime in Iran. I mean, they regard them as heretics and infidels, and in their public broadcasts it's said that they're damned to hell.
Really? And yet Al-Azhar University in 1954 said Shia Islam.
Well, Al-Azhar is a much more moderate and conservative institution than the Salafists funded by the Saudi Arabians.
We do have another call. Hello, you're on the air. Time for one more call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. A couple of things. I'll try to be quick. Professor Chejedovsky in Canada pointed out that from his reading of the situation, the very first event in Syria recently was he said it was an armed group coming into, it was a small border town, Daraa, I think it is, an unlikely place, he said, for the beginning of a social democracy movement, and that there were guns involved from the very beginning of the Syrian uprising, although obviously a lot of peaceful pro-democracy people got involved early on. And the other thing I've noticed is
very quick.
The financial scandal with the Standard Chartered Bank. The man who brought it was the New York State regulator Benjamin Meyer Lawsky, and he sort of trumped the Federal Reserve people. I'm wondering if there's some kind of anti-Iran thing going on there too. If you could comment on either.
Yeah, we just have a minute left here, so briefly.
In Daraa, which is a town on the border inside Syria, next to the border with Jordan, the uprising, such as it was, and it didn't begin as an uprising, such as it was, there were demonstrations by school students, and those demonstrations, the children were arrested and tortured, and then their parents and their families went out into the streets to demonstrate peacefully against the torture of their children. At that time, everyone said that Bashar al-Assad should have arrested the governor of Daraa and the military chief in Daraa who were responsible for this, and everyone in Daraa would have been satisfied with that. In the event he didn't, he waited 6 months before he arrested them, and it grew and grew. Remember, the Tunisian revolution began with one young man in the middle of the province, in the middle of nowhere, who set himself on fire, and it ended up setting the whole country on fire. It was unexpected. So often some of these things begin in places where you don't expect them to begin.
Charles Glass, unfortunately, we've run to the end of a very interesting hour, informative hour. We couldn't get into the question about the Standard Chartered Bank of London. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Takes on the World and shedding some light on the very complicated situation in Syria. I hope you may have a chance to get back and talk again. Thanks so much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much.